Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Our guest today is Andrew Lipstein, author of The Vegan, published by FSG, and it was released on July 11th. Andrew's previous novel is The Last Resort, last year, and he'll be continuing his prolific schedule with Something Rotten, which will be released in 2025. His writing has appeared also in McSweeney's, The Millions, the Los Angeles Review of Books, many other periodicals and papers. And he kind of works in financial services, I think still Robin Hood, and he builds tools for option traders. And, you know, so we're covered in algorithms today, but in actuality, haven't we always been? I mean, it's just a set of instructions for solving a problem or accomplishing something, you know, a recipe for goulash or a single strand of DNA's instructions to make each of us unique. But today, algorithms are usually referenced on CNBC or Bloomberg or Barron's when they tout the benefits or dangers of AI or its prognosis for investments in startups. And then ChatGPT, this generative pre-trained transformer that, you know, depending on who you listen to, may be a boon to mankind or a harbinger of our sixth extinction. So this guy, Herschel Cain, along with his buddy Milos, have invented, if you will, their own algorithm. Well, Milos has invented it pretty much. Herschel's like the upfront marketing and private equity angel investor kind of guy. So the process, the set of instructions that they have come up with, predicts the stock market, well, predicts and manipulates it to a certain extent, depending on your own moral compass. It's either a tool for making money or an evil device that will outsmart daily investors and the markets, creating chaos and evil. So Herschel, along with the stress of his day job, commits an act that any of us could perform, an act that does irrevocable harm. And the moral question posed here and in the book is whether blame and responsibility ought to destroy a life or whether absolution from this hard cause is even possible. So Herschel, in a slightly at first and then increasingly wacko manner, applies his panic and remorse to animals he meets and seemingly communicates with, while at the same time becomes the eponymous, that's the right word, vegan of the novel. So all hell ensues from beagles to anoles, from empathy to insanity. And here to tell us more is Andrew. So hi, Andrew, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, so have you ever taken ZQL?
Yeah, I have. And I regret it every time. I'm a terrible sleeper. And like Herschel in the book, I sort of tend to rotate between aids and just they're all terrible. But actually, the day before my book launch, I was very nervous to get sleep and took some ZQL in the hopes that it would give me a good night. And as usually happens, I woke up at 3 a.m. wired and unable to go back to sleep.
As we were talking right before we started, when you put ZQL, I thought, what a silly name. And I thought you made it up. I mean, I knew NyQuil. And then when I went to the drugstore and saw it there, at least the tablets, I was going, oh, it really does exist. But, and I talked a little bit about the book in the introduction, but, and I don't normally ask like Terry Gross questions, but do you want to set it up just a little bit so we can move on from there?
The book, you mean?
Yeah, because I go do off the wall questions and
yeah,
I'll forget that we're selling your book.
Yeah, so the book centers on Herschel Cain, a quant hedge fund CEO. He's on the cusp of a few things. His firm is about to make a breakthrough with their algorithm. Him and his wife are hosting their neighbors in the hopes of wooing them and making new best friends. And he and his wife are also potentially going to start trying to have a baby. So his wife's friend, a sort of posh British playwright in town, they invite her to a dinner party along with her neighbors in the hopes of basically leveraging her wife's friends into like a charming evening. And that friend turned out to be deeply annoying. And Herschel serves her a drink with some ZQL in an effort to hurry up her jet lag and get her out of the house. And the day after, he realizes that while she was waiting for an Uber, she slipped and hit her head and ended up in the hospital. That's the basic setup for the book. I don't think though it might sound like there are spoilers in there, it all happens in the first few chapters.
Yeah, plus the Washington Post and New York Times and everybody else said they already spoiled it more than I will. It's funny that you says, and this is where I go off, but it's funny that you talked about the metallic statues from the cover of Ayn Rand's books, because I remember those so clearly. And then yesterday, I had this massage from this Eastern European woman who looked exactly like the metal colossus in Deadpool. And it reminded me of that again. She was very nice, but she had this really strong European accent. Not that that means anything, but why did you use that? I mean, where did that come from?
I have no idea where that came from. I just thought it was, I think actually Herschel imagines that when he hears her voice, he hears a very clarion voice and thinks to himself, he tries to imagine where that voice would have come from, and he imagines those statues. I don't know where that thought came to me, actually.
I love stuff like that because it resonates with people who are familiar with it. And then what happens is you get more meaning out of that because you can imagine it and you remember how you felt when you read that book, even though your opinion might have changed. But then again, it leads into something like, so when you put something arcane in there that you know because of your business, like you say, but what is the reader supposed to think about the Baum-Welsh algorithm, which is designed as a set of instructions to estimate the parameters of a hidden Markov model? It's like,
yeah, well,
go ahead.
No, I mean, you know, as you said in your intro, I believe Herschel is the CEO and he actually is not the one developing the algorithm. And even throughout the book, it comes up that he maybe has a bit of an inferiority complex as far as his contributions to the firm, which is all to say that from his point of view, I think the reader is sort of alongside with him and not feeling like he has access to much that they don't. But these references, whether they're in finance or culture, in a book, I feel like always helps to ground the story as long as they're not used in a way that feels out of reach or unexplained.
You know, it's funny, when I was reading the book, and I don't mean this as a compliment, but it certainly sounds like one, especially when Herschel's interior monologues, it harkens back to Gogol because of the absurd and kind of Dostoevsky because Raskolnikov is, you know, it's an action without consequences. Not Kafka, but more Gogol or Dostoevsky. Did you ever like kind of think about that?
I didn't think about the connection to Crime and Punishment until I got a blurb from Andrew Martin that related it to Crime and Punishment. Gogol, I remember reading him in college and loving him, and perhaps that made an imprint on me, not in a way that was conscious. But I'm glad you said that it wasn't like Kafka, because I feel like every book that's a little weird gets labeled as Kafkaesque or something as a byword for like existentially off-putting or something like that.
I'm always amazed that he always gets the esque. Not everyone, Dostoevsky-esque, they don't get that.
Well, Kafka is such a brief word. You can add a bit to it and you're still can keep your breath.
Hey, did you ever read Bonfire of the Vanities?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked me that. So actually another interviewer asked, so I saw a connection between this book and that book. I actually have an intimate connection with that book because my dad read that book while he was holding me as a baby. So some of my first time on earth was spent within proximity of the Tom Wolfe novel.
Wow. So you and Sherman and Herschel have kind of a connection, you know. They didn't mean to do what they did. You know, that, well, that's the whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. To do what you do, and then you feel like horrible, but then you constantly are questioning yourself as to whether you're morally responsible. The act itself, you know, although legally it's a crime, you know, morally, that's kind of the central question of the book, along with the subplot.
Yeah, I love thinking about law and putting it into my books. I think all three of my books, the two already published and the one forthcoming, have a sort of undercurrent of law, or at least characters think about it and use it to parse right and wrong in reality. And what's funny about law is, like, by necessity, it has to be as black and white as possible, and it can assign blame and responsibility. But in reality, we do so many things that give us blame and guilt that we didn't mean to. and no part of law. I mean, of course, there's different categories of murder, for example, which involves guilt or intent or not intent. But in general, how the human psyche works and our inner morality, those things are really important and help us absolve ourselves sometimes if we didn't mean to do something. That's often used as a form of apology. I didn't mean to do that. I didn't mean for it to come out that way. And I think that's really interesting because in the end, all that matters on the effects that we have on other people are what we do and our actions and how they make other people feel and how they change other people's lives, not whether we intended to or not. And of course, intent in itself is such a gray zone because we sometimes do things that we very unconsciously want to do, but we wouldn't say that we intend to do them.
The worst thing for me being Jewish is that if I do something like that and it doesn't even hurt anybody, I still feel horrible.
Well, of course, guilt is a huge part of Jewish law and Jewish religion and Jewish culture, so much so that it is probably the trope that non-Jews think of when they think of Jewish life or Jewish family or domestic life.
So again, briefly, I mentioned it briefly before we started, is like, you know, when you write the book, the financial aspect of it, part of it, like on the daily financial things that are going on, you talk about interest rates being so low.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, how a day in the internet is like a year in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Look what's happened since you wrote it.
Well, some people say the interest rates are still low.
Well, true.
Yeah.
Based on my 8.75% mortgage rate in 1978. Yeah.
Right. No, but you know, the book doesn't take place in a specific year, just sort of in the indeterminate near future. But of course, there are passages where Herschel ruminates on the market and what it means for interest rates to be low, basically as a way to bring up this idea of prices not exactly corresponding to value and portraying financial instruments as inherently contrived, which I think is deeply fascinating.
How did you, there's a lot of food, there's food in the book, but how did you end up inserting cultural references like The City Rises, the painting, and Edward Hopper and other things like that?
Yeah, well, I think putting art in books is interesting as long as you are seeing it through a very specific point of view of a character. And I think how a character sees a given work is very telling, not just of them as a person, but them as a person in that moment. And the way that Herschel comes into contact with art and what it means to him in different parts of the book, they can be drastically different. So just to give you an example, when he meets with Ian, a sort of lackey for an investor he's trying to woo at a restaurant, he sees a piece of art and basically uses the fact that he looked it up earlier to establish some sort of cultural knowledge on his part, as basically like a negotiating strategy with Ian to make himself seem like learned. But then later Ian sends him a different work by that same artist, or he uses that as a Gmail address when he's basically sending a threat to him. So it's like kind of like this work that's used different from, you know, its original meaning as a work of art, and then even more contrived after that as like a piece to reference the initial dinner. And then of course, when Herschel has his breakdown or epiphany later on in the book, he goes to MoMA, and what he sees in art is, and how he connects with them or doesn't connect to them, is defining his current state. So he hates Hopper because Hopper consecrates modern solitude and almost excuses it. But then he loves the Italian futurists because they're all about action and revolt and even invoking terrible moral acts in the name of some higher ideal, which resonates deeply with him.
It's funny because you said epiphany. I was just going to use the word because in a certain sense, Herschel has a series. It's almost like serial epiphanies, whether it's with animals or with his chameleons or whether it's at the zoo or these pieces of art. But those moments of epiphany, as a reader, and of course I'm entitled to think anything I want to think, but as a reader, it's kind of like all these moments of epiphany could easily simply be blocking efforts.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean exactly?
Well, so like when he looks at the dog, the beagle, and the beagle is obviously not commiserating with him, but he feels an enormous amount of empathy. And when he takes such care of the Annalies, and when he's going through what he then in retrospect calls his period of insanity, that period of insanity is made up of these moments, which are great.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, you wouldn't consider that maybe just moments of clarity, but the clarity is insane. He says it's insane.
Yeah, I think that's funny about clarity, because the term itself implies that there's like one truth, when in fact, sometimes, especially at emotionally heightened states, we believe things with such conviction that the conviction itself should be a sign that we are under the sway of something that isn't going to last forever. I think if you think of the moments in our lives that we feel most intensely, you know, first falling in love, finding a new passion, finding a new worldview that helps you in whatever you need to be doing at the stage of life you're in. These are all things that are going to go away or not sustainable. And that's definitely true of Herschel's, what I would call an epiphany.
I guess, you know, and this, I'm not spoiling anything because all the reviews have said it, but when he goes to the zoo and takes his clothes off, in some ways, to me, that felt like the pivotal moment in the book, because he did something, he didn't get the response he wanted, and then later on, he thinks about how absurd it was. Plus, he was also committing a criminal act at that time, and how could he think he wasn't going to get caught? Those kinds of things.
The criminal act, you mean breaking into the zoo?
Breaking into the zoo, and then,
yeah,
I guess public exposure or whatever, or just the fact that fairly obviously somebody might see him, or somebody probably would see him.
Because I mean, breaking into the zoo is definitely a crime. I think given the fact no one else was there, well, it's funny that we don't consider it public exposure to expose ourselves to a zoo animal, because why would it be, you know? And he sees getting naked in front of that animal as like a much more, he is sort of like a very contrived effort to get on their level, you know, but he does recognize that that animal has probably never seen a human naked, I think, which is sort of an absurd fact. Like we look at animals naked all the time and we're in their presence, they're in ours, but they've never like seen our bodies. I think that is stunning and speaks to our relationship with the natural world, that we feel that we're always covering ourselves up.
Plus, he doesn't get the response. He doesn't get the response he expected.
From the animal, he sort of does. It runs away, but just by running away and establishing that it's afraid of him, he does state that he feels that their relationship is that of animals, that he's scared an animal. And that's the relationship of his animals, as opposed to what we normally do when we go into zoos, which is, you know, we've contained these animals and we're sort of watching them. We're being voyeurs to them, but we're not actually interacting with them in any way.
It always struck me as funny, like in Disney, or not Disney, Merry Melody is like Porky Pig. He wears like a jacket, but the anatomically correct parts of him are still exposed, which makes it even more prurient, I think, because he's wearing something up here.
Well, I think it's actually supposed to be not purient, because we show the lack of genitals to establish that pig doesn't have genitals. I think if we covered up the pig's genitals, we would be implying that it had genitals. And I think that would break some of the assumptions required to make such a cartoon.
This is a topic you're not going to get out. That was something you would get asked about generally in an interview.
Not in my day to day, definitely not.
Of what if you know, because the animals are not only a diversion to him, but a raison d'être, I guess. Doesn't everybody impute anthropomorphic characteristics to their pets anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they usually do it in a loving way. You know, if we have a dog, and you know, we sometimes, I don't have a dog, but some people cuddle them and think that the dog is experiencing what they experience as cuddles. Sometimes when the dog's being bad, they think the dog is like revolting against them, rebelling as like a teenager might. I mean, I think our relationship to animals is deeply anthropomorphic, and we can't help but see them as humans simultaneously using their lower status to basically make them suit our own purposes.
Well, so like with the annelids, which I just call chameleons, because living in Florida for 30 years, I mean, they were just all over, like iguanas. Mm-hmm. Why did you pick those as precious objects for him? Very precious.
Yeah, well, I actually have, when I was a kid, I think when I was around 10, I had two anoles, and one basically killed the other by stealing crickets out of her mouth. So basically forcing her to be starved to death. And I think even back then I sensed that it was my fault that that had happened, because I had placed them in the same cage, and that wouldn't have happened in a more natural environment. And so I had experience with them, and sort of like a slightly traumatic experience with them. So I thought it would be interesting to work that into the novel.
Usually when I pull the tails come right off. And then one time I had this boa constrictor named Nestor, and I put an iguana with him overnight, thinking, well, they're both cold-blooded, so he's not going to go after him. And then when I came down in the morning, I had already wrapped him up and was getting ready to eat him, and I separated them. But yeah, I felt tremendous guilt. But that reminds me, so you should, I have the book here, but do you have it there? You should hold up the cover, because owning a bookstore, that's what sells them.
Well, I don't have one within reach, but there it is.
And again, even though it doesn't happen that way in the book, you have this really interesting picture, not only of the champagne glass, if that's what it is, but the actual eating of one creature by another. And it's like, it's, and as I say in every interview, everyone who says you can't judge a book by its cover does. Every single person who comes into my bookstore, unless they know what they're getting.
Right.
So this is a great cover, don't you think?
I love the cover. I think it matches the tone of the book really well. I mean, there's the imagery, but there's also the tone, which is like sort of irreverent, sort of satirical, obviously dark.
Yeah. The black part is good too, which also as a bookseller goes to The Epigraph by John Berryman.
Mm-hmm.
Since, you know, I'll just read it. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns. We ourselves flash and yearn. Mm-hmm. And I always figure authors must spend a lot of time thinking about the epigraph, because it kind of encapsulates the book to a certain extent.
Yeah. So
I have an idea of what it means. What did it mean to you?
Well, I'll also say that for a period, the name of the book was Flash and Yearn, and we changed that, my publisher and I. There's two things I want to say about the epigraph. I mean, the first is obviously that this idea of us mirroring the natural world, and us basically getting our own emotions from things we see in the natural world. But the first line of that poem, which is Dream Songs 14, is life, friends, is boring. We must not say so. And that line before, after all the sky flashes, the great sea yearns, we ourselves flash and yearn, puts a sort of, I think, ironic spin on it. You know, life is boring. You know, we can't say it. After all, the sky flashes, the great sea yearns. It's almost like we know these things are great. We know these things are immensely powerful and almost above us. But just to say it, sometimes we can't help but feel like bored or detached from it as well, which I think matches our relationship with the natural world, and of course Herschel's as well. What was your assumption about it?
I looked at it as macro and micro. I looked at it as like the universe does exactly what we do. And then I thought of algorithms, because I'm so hung up on them, and that I realize we all are stuck with these rules, and everyone's saying, oh, ChatGPT has these rules that govern its behavior and it can only go here and go on. And it's the same with us. we mm-hmm. have the same instructions. And I was thinking of the universe having its own instructions, and then on a much smaller basis, since I always think we're kind of in the middle of everything, we have the same emotions, the same feelings.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I thought about it.
Well, algorithms are interesting too, because we program them. We decide on the rules, and it's not like they ever do something that is original or creative or outside of what we say. And I think AI is so scary because it makes us firm up and make concrete our exact priorities. I mean, even if you think about self-driving cars and the fact that they will do or will soon lead to less deaths, we still have to program in some sort of calculation or priorities within them, such as if the car is about to kill 10 people on a crosswalk and it has the opportunity to kill the driver, what should it do? You know, I don't think anyone would disagree that it should kill the driver, but just the fact that we need to state these things, I think, is deeply unnerving and not very natural to how our mind is built.
Yeah, I always think in a situation like that, I always think of Isaac Asimov's three rules of robotics.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I'm hung up on it right now, and I interview these guys like David Chalmers and Donald Hoffman about the seat of human consciousness, and Chalmers wrote this book called Reality Plus. And so then I'm thinking, half of them are talking about this being a simulation, you know, what we're doing now, or maybe even solipsistic, where only one of us is talking to the other and the other's not here. And it's like, there's no way we can disprove it. It's like Gödel's theory of incompleteness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so why would you even think that we are not as algorithmic as the program that Milos devises? Aren't we governed by the same type of structure?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this debate also sometimes bleeds out into the debate over free will, whether free will exists or not, which is, I think, deeply abstract. But then once it becomes less abstract, it sort of is almost absolving of anything we do, almost like the insanity plea in a murder trial. I think these debates are fine in a vacuum, but as far as how they should impact our actual moral priorities, I think that they mean nothing. But it's interesting you brought up Gödel's incompleteness theorem, because a lot of the book obviously deals with language and its attempts and often inability to capture reality and to help us make sense of things. And I think there isn't any greater example of his incompleteness theorem than language, because, and when I say language, I mean human language as well as mathematical language or logical language, because to even describe what it is, to describe what's going on when we use language, like, we would need a bigger tool than language itself. Language breaks itself. It absorbs all meaning, and it's great at conveying hard information. But as far as like having control over itself, you know, language has no tentpole. It isn't grounded. It's only relative. Words and meanings and phrases and terms are all relative to each other. And I think in a system like that, it becomes impossible to view it from the outside.
That reminded me of something, because you're talking about language, and you know, Herschel gets hung up on language, and then he watches that video and then gets that book. And then, of course, I hate the term, but going down the rabbit hole, I watched and read that. So what's the name of the language guy that gave that little speech, but Herschel didn't watch 2 minutes of it?
You read David Abrams' book?
Yeah.
Really? After you read The Vegan?
Yeah.
Great. The Spell of the Sensuous is the name of the book.
But the YouTube video, that guy, what was his name?
Yeah, oh, David Abrams.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Well, and the reason I only watched 2 minutes of it, and I was thinking of Umberto Eco, because it was like semiotics to me. I mean, the guy starts talking. I didn't like his hair. I didn't like his earring. I didn't like his Birkenstocks. I didn't like the way he was sitting on the chair. And I didn't like his self-satisfied way of speaking, so I just turned it off.
Mm-hmm. But you read the book.
I haven't read the book. I've gone through the book and looked at it. I tend to embellish, as my wife says. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, he looks the part. He looks like somebody who would advocate for the natural world in a way that I think we've become a little bit like repulsed by, which is part of the reason why I thought it was fun or funny or interesting to put those views into someone like Herschel Cain, who doesn't look the part and wouldn't wear Birkenstocks or let his hair go beyond 4 inches on top.
Didn't like the earring.
Mm-hmm.
But he only watched it for 2 minutes, right? Which is exactly how long I watched it for. But the thing about it is, you know, it's true. I mean, there's so much like portmanteau stuff in this book because there's so many different situations like that that you put into a couple hundred pages. And it's like, so you mentioned free will. So for good or for bad, that's all that Crime and Punishment is about. Mm-hmm. And the absurd nature of it is exactly what The Overcoat or The Nose is about by Gogol. And it really does. They really do dovetail into the book, whether you meant to or not, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you touch certain issues, you can't help but move into realms that have been written about before. Yeah.
When you were talking to Emma Alpern, who writes for Vulture and works for chief copywriter of New York Magazine, when you were talking to her at the zoo in Brooklyn, she put in the article about how she suggested that Herschel was a bad person, and you kind of took umbrage.
Yeah. Well, she said that he does. Maybe we should look it up to make sure we know it exactly.
Got it somewhere.
That he, I think, does bad things. Let's see here.
Well, she even, you know, because she even titled it that you try to be good.
When I point out that she says, when I point out that Herschel does bad things in the novel, he asks what I mean, seeming defensive on his character's behalf. Yeah. I mean, she could have been referring to any number of things. But I am always curious when people label actions good or bad. And I think the point of a novel is to erase those lines completely.
Well, yeah, but you're talking about gray areas. There certainly are black and white areas, whether you're talking about murder or Trump. I mean,
well, what do you think that Herschel did anything that could be classified and only classified as bad?
No, but there are some other negative characteristics about him, maybe weakness. And weakness in some situations is bad. I mean, I like good old fashioned clean evil rather than like Hillary Clinton, who's like dirty evil. That's a hard thing to say, but it's true though. Because she's unlikable and she would step on anybody. But yeah, so I like nice clean evil. It's very easy to spot. And that's another thing as a bookseller that's going to make this book really popular. Well, not only will it be in a book club at our store and everyone's going to argue about it, it'll be this very argument, whether Herschel's bad or good. Mm-hmm. He's bad or just put in a bad place. That'll be the argument. And I always say it's like Fight Club because they'll be on both sides of the table. How could he do this? How could he not go to whoever and confess what he had done? But what I was going to get at was the idea that the books that really work are the books that when you close the cover, which I did, the first thing I go is, what the hell is going to happen now?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen in a real world. And then I thought, oh, maybe this is just like an allegory or it's a fable, in which case I don't really have to worry about what's going to happen. But in the real world, I think I know exactly what's going to happen. And it's not good.
Well, I think there's the question of what's going to happen. I think there's the other question of what do you as a reader think about how the book ends, and we won't say how the book ends, but you know, I think if a book is gonna, in a book like this is going to succeed in a book club, like you'll have on it, if people really vehemently disagree with each other over his goodness. Because I think if a book is going to attack the issue of morality, it should be divisive because we all have different moral priorities. And if a moral question is specific enough, it should divide people, I think.
Yeah, and it does in the world today, except the absence of civil discourse and each person knowing what the other side's doing wrong, whether it's abortion or the death penalty or immigration or trans people, you know, each person for generally is not going to listen to the other's position. If they do, they're not going to change their mind. Mm-hmm. Whereas in your book, there are implications that could go either way, depending on what kind of person you are, what kind mm-hmm. of outcome you have.
True.
Yeah. So I think I definitely do think, oh yeah, that's the other thing is that there's a lot of humor in the book. And that's another thing as a bookseller that drives people through the book. I mean, mm-hmm. they're not sure whether they like everything about it. If they know they're going to be laughing on the next page, they will enjoy reading it.
Right. I mean, you talk about a book called The Vegan that's going to be speaking about our relationship with the natural world, a novel. If you don't have humor in it, who can make it through? Just the most green PC people in the world, right? They're the only ones who are going to enjoy it. Not that the purpose of the humor is just to add a little sugar enough that I can shove vegetables down the reader's mouths, because of course I don't care to make a point about the natural world. It's up to the reader, I think. But I think if it's going to be like life, a book, then it has to be equally as humorous and awkward and weird as the people and situations, the people we meet and the situations we find ourselves in.
Well, you seem to kind of like not be ambivalent, but maybe I'm saying, you know, Herschel has this series of epiphanies. And I still mm-hmm. think that whether you do or not, because like that first moment where he tries to eat animal and he can't, and he has mm-hmm. visceral response that he's never had in his life before. And then when he's over in his insanity, again, not spoiling it, that changes. But I consider that a moment of epiphany. I mean, he does this thing and he realizes immediately, he's enlightened. He mm-hmm. realizes immediately, this is wrong. I can't do this anymore. It's just impossible for me to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think he's repulsed by food. And often when we are, you know, being repulsed by something is like a zero order reaction to it. We are not telling ourselves how we should feel about it. It's totally emotional. And I think that is important to him because it feels like it makes it seem like it's real, his epiphany, as opposed to like, I've done a bad thing. I need to be good to rebalance my morality ledger.
Yeah.
Let me like find a way to be good.
It's funny because, you know, you think of the word rumination and the whole book he's ruminating, but I didn't know about, tell us about what ruminating is. I had no idea what it was.
Yes. Yeah, so rumination syndrome is like a very rare disorder where humans, usually infants or the insane, but happens to regular adults too, basically regurgitate their food just to chew it again. And this is something that animals do, obviously, like cows, they chew up their cud and they re-chew their cud. And I just love that detail because first of all, it only happens to infants and the insane. And maybe I wanted to provoke readers into wondering which of those two categories Herschel would be a part of. And it also connected him to animals, and especially as it turns out, animals that he as a Jew is not supposed to eat.
Yeah, it's funny because it made me think of the characters in the book, because they kind of, well, his wife, the Rothschild couple, and a couple across the street. It's like, I was thinking, okay.
The Guggenheim, you mean?
Yeah, what did I say? Rothschilds?
Rothschild, yeah.
Yes. The thing about the characters in the book, there's not really, oh yeah, there is one villain, two villains, one villain. But for the most part, they try to be supportive, even if they figure, oh man, this guy is like going off the rails. But his wife is, I wouldn't call her a martyr, but she's a really loving person. And there's several times in the book where you express the fact that there's a great deal of love between them too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, I mean, what Franny ends up being is the moral center of the book. And we won't talk about what happens at the end, but her her existence in Herschel's life both frees him to ignore the moral questions that he has to deal with and ends up absolving him from it. But she's also sort of what ends up bringing him back to reality.
Yeah, another pivotal part of the book was, and I'll phrase it in such a fashion that it doesn't spoil anything, is the evening after the accident, you know, he goes to bed and he does something. And the reader and he think that maybe there was a perception that later on turned out not to be true, depending on how you interpret Franny's algorithm, you know? That was pretty cool.
Wait, what do you mean?
Before he goes to bed, he decides he'll do the same thing just to get to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But he's kind of jovial as to what he did and thinks it was a funny joke.
Right, yeah.
And he thinks she is in on the joke too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. You mean when they communicate when he thinks that he's told her what he's done and then later on it turns out, that's what you mean,
yeah. Yeah, that was good because I thought, okay, she's in on it too. And then I thought, well, mm-hmm. is she? And actually, you know what? I still don't know. I'm not sure 100%. Are you?
I'm sure.
So what paintings do you have behind you?
This is a photograph of a recreation of aerospace program in an African country. And then these are just clippings of reviews of my first novel. But right there is a authentic newspaper from 1945 in Denmark when Germany capitulated. My wife is Danish, and I don't know how she got her hands on that, but it says Germany has capitulated, Denmark is free at last.
What's over your right shoulder on the sidewall?
Oh, this over here?
Yeah.
This is my wife's ex-boyfriend photograph from the Dead Sea of men who are trying to treat their eczema by lying naked by the ocean.
That says something about her ex-boyfriend, I guess.
He's apparently a talented photographer.
Yeah. And my garage, you know, we moved last year and my garage is still full of stuff. And my wife is my producer, but she'll probably take this out. But anyway, so like I'll open a box and there's like this really nice wooden eagle. And she'll say, well, just get rid of it. You haven't seen it in 10 years. And I go, yeah, but I got that with Margie, who's my ex-wife. And she gets really upset. She's going to take this out. She got mad at me last time for doing this.
Well, what's your wife's name?
Carrie.
Carrie, I dare you to leave it in.
All right. Well, as we wind up, I'll ask you a Terry Ghost question. So, you've indicated that your new book also contains elements of law. Can you tell us a little bit about more about your new book?
Yeah. So my new book is called Something Rotten and it takes place in Copenhagen. It's about an American male and his Danish wife who take their child leave. They have a new baby to spend the summer in Copenhagen. And they arrive to find that her ex is quite ill and not everything is as it seems.
Wow. It sounds like you're describing your room.
Yeah, it's good that you asked that question about the paintings beforehand.
Okay, well, it was a pleasure talking to you, Andrew. I really enjoyed the book and it'll be on our front table. And perhaps one day when you come back to visit Haverford, you can come out our way and see our bookstore.
Thank you so much for talking to me, Sam. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.